Welcome, everyone, to the Union Federation podcast, where we discuss both Star Trek and the Orville here on the Fandom Podcast Network. We're really excited because we are diving into Star Trek Picard Season 3, Episode 7, Dominion. But first, guys, we have a spoiler alert. Did I mention spoiler alert? Oh, and by the way, spoiler alert. Shaw says spoiler alert, so watch out for that, guys. All right. Well, first of all, I need to get my crew on here. Now, we have kind of a skeleton crew, but it's technically the best part of the crew. Don't tell anyone else I said anything. So, with me, as always, I want to add Miss Haley. How are you? Let's go ahead.
Hello.
And let's make it. There you go. You are our science officer and the Oracle, right?
I am. Yeah. And I'm rocking the science today. I chose the blue one today. So I'm super excited to be here. Also, in light of the news that we are getting a Starfleet, I went to California a few years ago and I'm wearing my San Francisco hoodie. So, yay! Hey, I am prepared today.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I know. That's right, why I'm the Oracle. So, you know.
So Kyle can't be with us today because, well, it is officially April 1st. Yes, that's April Fool's Day as we were recording this. But it's no joke that he is stuck doing taxes. He is on an away mission on Planet Taxia. And tax season not only has already started for him, but it is officially kicked in hardcore. So he can't be with us today. And our first officer and counselor, Amy Nelson, she's at a prom. I'm guessing it has something to do with school and maybe she's a chaperone or policing things. I don't know. But she'll hopefully be back next week. So, but we have a special guest ambassador, author, Mr. John Mosby. How are you, sir?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Mr. Echo Chamber himself, man. You've been there.
Very nice to be here again, sir.
All right. Well, we are going to dive right into it here. We are discussing Star Trek Picard Season 3, Episode 7, Dominion. But we also have, guys, we've got a little bit of news. All right, guys. It has been announced. We have Strange New Worlds Season 2 to release on June 15. Star Trek Strange New Worlds aired an incredible first season last summer, but since then, news on the show's second season has been sparse. Knowing that Season 2 has already been filmed has had fans eager to know when they'll be seeing Captain Pike, Anson Mount, and the delightful crew of the USS Enterprise again, and now Paramount has an answer. The crew will return to the bridge on June 15th, just in time for summer, and that was relat information that I got off of Collider.com. John, are you excited for Star Trek Strange New World Season 2?
I am. I like everybody, I was a little bit trepidatious about what was going to be happening when the first season launched, because it seemed to be ticking all the boxes in all its pre-publicity and everything. But Star Trek can be Marmite. You know, fans can be very fickle. We can be. But I was delighted with the first season. I thought there was a lot more hits than misses. It took some chances, which is good. But it seemed to evoke a classic Star Trek while still being quite modern. And the fact that we've got a season two, I think, was inevitable. I think the fact that they're already starting to film the third, from what I understand, because of the potential writer's strike. So, it's all good news there.
Haley, I know you're excited because Mr. Captain Shiny Pants, as you've nicknamed him, I've nicknamed Captain Hair. Captain Handsome, your thoughts on Star Trek Strange New World Season 2?
Oh my God, I'm so excited. I have not been this excited about a Star Trek show in a really, really long time. So I'm so excited that it's coming back. I'm actually liking that we don't have a lot of information. As you know, Kevin, I don't like watching in the ready room. I immediately turn it off when they're like, hey, we've got a sneak peek of next episode. Nope. I don't want to know nothing. I want to be blind. I want to be surprised as to what's going on. So the fact that we don't know anything makes me really excited because I would rather be that way. I mean, we're all old enough to know. We didn't have spoilers. We didn't have all of this stuff when we were growing up. And so you never knew what you were going to get the next season. So I love it. And I'm so excited. And oddly, how funny is it that there's a potential writer strike for the third season? Because didn't that happen with TNG?
Yeah. John, when is this writer's strike? I forgot about this. When is this supposed to happen? Do you know?
Well, there isn't necessarily going to happen at the moment. They're in tough negotiations at the moment, and everybody's trying to find a way around it. But it's one of those things where if they have the potential to do it, they're starting to film new episodes. I know Quantum Leap, which has its finale this Monday, I know they've already filmed four episodes of season two, largely because they could do it. They have the sets. So any series that's got standing sets and everything else lines up, they're going quickly as possible into filming over the summer, so that they can avoid any strike that might come in the next few months, and so they have product ready. So we'll see what happens.
Thanks for the insight on that. I'm really excited for Star Trek season two of Strange New Worlds. Going into it, I was a little apprehensive, but I loved Anson Mount, of course, being introduced in Discovery, and I was really excited to see what happened. And as we talked about it here on Union Federation, we were so happy that it kind of jumped to a episodic television mission of the week type of thing while we were getting to know our characters. And John, you were right. There was definitely a lot more hits. There was maybe a couple little misses here. There was one episode I wasn't a big fan of. I think it was the Doctor episode. That was a really weird one. But overall, I was really impressed with how well the crew seemed to kind of mesh together and kind of feel comfortable with each other, whether it was Pike, having his little barbecues and meetings and just other people kind of getting together and bonding. I thought it was great. But next, we also have news here. Star Trek Lower Decks season 4, Paramount Plus has announced today that will be boarding the USS Cerritos for a new mission, with Star Trek Lower Decks season 4 set to return on the streamer later this summer. Star Trek's adult animated series Lower Decks follows a handful of ensigns working on the Starfleet's most menial jobs aboard one of the Federation's less high-profile Cerritos California-class starship. The hit comedy series was renewed for a fourth season, well ahead of its third, which debuted on Paramount Plus last summer, and also season 3, which is getting a Blu-ray, DVDs, and digital release. This spring was filled with delightful surprises, including cameos, Easter eggs, and plot twists, and more. John, I want to go back to you. Have you, I don't know your thoughts on Lower Decks. Did you give it a shot? Was it for you? What's your deal with that?
I've seen bits and pieces of it. It's not, there's just been so much on television to keep up with that I kind of watched the first couple of episodes and went, oh, this is fun. And then somehow it's kind of got a little bit lost in the shuffle. I've seen subsequent ones, but not quite with the regularity of all the others. It's just, I think we're living in a golden age of TV at the moment. There's just so many hours in a day and not everything you can fit in.
Yeah, well, I was a huge fan of it. I was really caught off guard about how much I enjoyed it. And I know that Haley and Amy and I, we were like, and even Kyle, we were like, is this going to work? And with all of the wonderful connective tissue and Easter eggs and fun fan service, we've been really enjoying it. But it's found its own foot with the characters, and you've really kind of come into they've come into their own. Haley, what are your thoughts on Lower Decks season 4?
I'm excited for everybody else who's really, really excited about it. I mean, I'll watch it because it's Star Trek, and I'm not gonna like.
Okay.
Again, I'm not one of those people that like watches it to hate watch it, like people have been saying. Right. Like, I don't hate watch it. It's just not mine. So it's lower on the tier of my Star Trek enjoyment, but I can appreciate it for what it is and that people love it.
We're going to be totally completely honest when it comes to the half hour shows, the Prodigy and this one, the animated shows. We watch them because they're Star Trek, but we're not going week to week with these things when we cover them. Usually we cover like two or three episodes at a time, and then because sometimes there's some connective tissue between the previous episodes and stuff. And it's fun to kind of talk about it once you've seen it, but it's not affecting my sleeping habit like Mandalorian and Star Trek Picard. So I watch it when it happens. But we did get some news here. Haley, as you mentioned, Starfleet Academy has officially been announced here. And what we got here says, and I got this from Variety. Star Trek series set at Starfleet Academy has officially been ordered by Paramount Plus. Variety has learned. The series has been in the works for some time as Variety first reported on the development of Starfleet Academy show in 2018, though that project has a different creative team. Variety wants to remind you that it's been there from the beginning. I love that. The premiere episode hails from writer and executive producer, Gaia Viallo, if I'm pronouncing that right, if I'm not, my apology. Alex Kurtzman, who oversees the Star Trek TV universe for Paramount, will serve as executive producer and co-showrunner along with Noga Landau, Aaron Bayers, Jenny Lumet, Rod Roddenberry, Trevor Roth, Frank Siracusa, and John Weber, also executive produce. CBS Studio produces in association with Kurtzman's Secret Hideout and Roddenberry Entertainment. Secret Hideout, Lumet, and Roddenberry Entertainment are currently under overall deals at CBS Studios. John, I want to go with you on this. This has been rumored for quite a long time here. And it's something we've kind of want to see, though. But the question is, and I don't know when and what time frame it's going to take place, but the idea that we're having new cadets come in and have this, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it's probably one of the most long-standing rumors and the almost one of the sort of long-standing projects that we've thought, is it going to happen? You know, it's a bit like the Highlander movie. You know, it's just like, is it going to happen? I'm cautiously optimistic. I don't know whether it's going to be for me or not. I know they've said very much it's going to be a kind of young adult feel, and that's a very broad range of coverage. I've seen a lot of stuff where young adult covers a vast range, and on one end, it's no interest to me, and on the other hand, it's absolutely brilliant. So it kind of depends whether it's going to have a CW vibe with lots of attractive people getting into trouble every week, or whether there's going to be a little bit more to it than that. There's potential. I think there's huge potential for it. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been bubbling under for so long. It all depends on who they cast, the execution. I think it's too early to know, but it's going to be very interesting to see how it develops.
Haley, your thoughts on this? And do we know, have we heard like a time frame when this takes place?
Yeah, I'm excited. Again, I mean, this is 5 years in the making. And I know we discussed this originally when all these talks of shows coming out and things like that were going to happen. And so I'm really intrigued because there's a lot of directions that they could take this. It could very much be geared to the late teens, early 20-year-old audience. But if they throw in some of our beloved characters as instructors or whatever else, it could really pull in a lot of people who are currently fans of Star Trek. So I'm thoroughly intrigued by where this will take place. And because it's Starfleet Academy, I mean, it could be anywhere. It could be in any time frame. It could start and like progress through some of the shows that we already love. You know, I mean, we could look at, you know, I mean, really any time, and it could be really cool. I mean, it could be an alternate timeline. It could be in a different timeline. It could be, you know, the J.J. Abrams 09 timeline of like Starfleet Academy. Who knows?
That's a good point. Yeah. You know, for me personally, I would love to see it maybe after Picard or something like that. And the reason why is because I really want to see where they're taking the Federation. And also, you have a chance to have some of the crew and cast of now, you know, whether we do get any legacy characters coming in. But I'd also be fine if they kind of did something back with they're doing, you know, with Strange New Worlds or something like that, you know, because then you see the beginning of what's happening and then you could have some of those character intermix. But I think it would be really nice to have some type of legacy character be introduced and be a regular or something like that. I know we can't get Boothby, but that would be nice. Haley?
No, I just totally had an idea. This would be kind of a good show because we have yet to fill that gap between the original series and TNG. How many years are there in between those two where we have talked about, like, can't we stick a show in there? Everything's either coming pre-TOS or after Voyager. Like, what about something right in that gap? Because, I mean, really, there could be so much discovered with, like, you know, Peace with the Klingons and, like, discovering more in the galaxy and whatnot, because, you know, in TOS it was limited, and then there was so much more with TNG, and then even more in Deep Space Nine. Like, there is that gap of window. That might be a good time frame for that to fit in. Is, or something else, please.
Is this our master plan to try to get Monster Maroons uniforms back into Star Trek.
Maybe, I don't know. I mean, as long as we skip the, you know, TMP, let's just forgo the onesies, please.
Awesome. All right, guys, let's go ahead and head out of news. All right, we are discussing season 3, episode 7, Dominion. We got a lot of stuff to talk about here, but first, we have the Admiral's log here with Haley. Give us the lowdown here.
The Titan hides amid shipwrecks in the Chintaka battle space. Geordi works against Lore's persona to restore Data's dominance of the android's mind. Worf and Raffi take La Serena out on another intelligence mission. Seven tries to contact her former crewmate, Tuvok. The respondent passes Seven's first trust test, but fails her second, revealing himself to be a changeling and leaving the real Tuvok's fate ambiguous. Picard, surmising that the changelings are using his corpse to target Starfleet's anniversary festivities, devises and enacts a plan to trap Vadic and her crew on the Titan with force fields, using Jack, who is developing telepathy, and Sydney as bait. Picard and Beverly interrogate Vadic in the trap. Vadic reveals she was one of 10 changelings whom Starfleet doctors torturously experimented on to develop a breed of super spies. Upon their escape, she swore revenge and formed the rogue changeling faction, taking her torturer's form. Beverly confirms the experiment's existence. Picard realizes he has to kill Vadic, but Geordi fails to revive Data in time to stop Lore from taking over the Titan's computers and disabling the force fields, allowing Vadic to escape, storm Titan's bridge, and announce she knows Jack's true nature.
To be continued. Dun, dun, dun. Jeez. All right, John, I want to dive into you real quick. Your first reactions to this.
Well, this season, I mean, it's been, I know previously, I'm a big Star Trek fan, but I think we all admit the last two seasons of Picard have been very up and down. This has been consistently good. Now, I'm not saying that not every episode has been, you know, like A plus, 100 out of 100, the same way that every scene in a movie isn't, you know, the climactic, you know, thing we always remember. But this season has been such an improvement, and it's been such a great mix of things. This is a slower episode, a little bit. I mean, obviously, people aren't just sitting around talking, but we've had some real big, memorable moments in previous episodes. This is more connective tissue, but I enjoyed it. We're getting to the point in the season where I'm sort of like crossing my fingers and going, "Don't mess it up! Don't mess it up! Don't mess it up." And we're right on that kind of hint, that kind of pivot point as we, you know, getting to episode 7. We've only got 3 episodes left. Obviously, the finale will be a big climactic moment. The penultimate episode will, you know, be leading us up to that. So this and episode 8 next week's are really going to be the thing that prepares us for that. I think it's doing a good job. I'm enjoying it. It feels like classic this Next Generation, but with a modern feel, and so far most of the time I think it's getting it right. There are elements in there I'm not sure about, but I'm still thoroughly enjoying it. I'm tuning in. I'm not a huge fan of The Mandalorian, I have to say. I mean, The Mandalorian on a Wednesday and Star Trek on a Thursday, it's Star Trek that I'm waiting for more. I'm enjoying it. I think it's very, very good. We'll see when we get to the end about the whole package, but so far I think it's pretty good.
Haley, your thoughts, first reactions to Dominion.
Oh my gosh. So in last week's episode, I didn't know where we were going to go this week. And so I was utterly surprised where this episode went. I was not expecting it. Aside from Data Lore, I was not expecting anything else. And I'm thoroughly intrigued. And like John said, I really hope that they're able to tie everything up and wrap everything up together really well, because if there's any loose threads, which has been a chief complaint about another show that we've discussed, if there's any loose threads to any of these storylines, I'm going to be very, very disappointed, very upset. There was lots of swearing again, lots of beep, 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 beep. I'm not even going to go there because this is too family friendly. And I pins and needles. I cannot wait till next week because, oh, Jesus.
Yeah, I agree. This season has been firing on all cylinders. A lot of these analogies have been put out there. Has been hailed well by a lot of fans. And it's funny though, because something you said, John, this episode mm-hmm. wasn't my favorite because it was a little bit slower paced, but there was a lot to chew on, especially on a rewatch. You know, there might've been some things that you missed and stuff, but yeah, I love how we're slowly getting stuff done here. We're slowly getting stuff fed to us. It's not all being thrown out there. I love how the crew is working together. It's really weird though. When you go back to TNG, usually they always went to either engineering or like the ready room to figure out what they were going to do, you know, but now they're like, you know, either in hallways or they're like, you know, leaning on the bridge in a way or they're doing stuff like that. And I like mm-hmm. that. I like that because the set is really, really amazing. But I did want to mention one thing that's been kind of going around on social media. And I shared this meme here, guys. Episode 1, who is this a-hole? Episode 7, if they kill him off, I'm suing Paramount. We're all feeling this way about Captain Shaw and Todd's performance. I was afraid he was going to get killed in this episode. I will be totally honest with you guys. I am loving Shaw here. I love him, Todd himself, because he's a big fan himself. I want to get your quick thoughts on this. John, do you want to see him hang around a little bit longer?
Let's be perfectly honest. If they killed him off, and they shot the scene where they killed him off, I guarantee they're going back into the studio right now and reshooting that. I mean, I was watching that. I was watching the video where, right at the end where he gets hurled into the lift, and I'm going like, "Oh my god, they're going to kill him!" And I thought just for a second, and then like, you know, then everything went, "Nah, there's no way they're going to do that." I wondered if for a second if they'd reshot that, but I don't think anybody anticipated how popular the character was going to be. And genuinely, it's not just a, you know, like stunt casting or whatever. This is a good actor in an interesting role that we want to see more of. So, yeah, I mean, there was that moment where I thought, are they going to kill him? Then clearly they're not going to do that. It's going to be interesting to see what they do with him over the next few episodes, though. I mean, there's still a chance they did kill him off and they're having to, you know, sweat that one out. But I don't know how much he has to do. I don't think anybody will have anticipated quite the scale of the reaction. So, he didn't have that much to do this episode, but, you know, just being there, it's just like, yep, okay, he's still alive. Continue.
You know what? Why not have the Titan show happen? That's been speculated with fans. Yeah. Then they drop in on Starfleet Academy, the new show, you know, maybe pick some people that just graduated and then you have that show established. I don't know, but just an idea. Haley, what are your thoughts on Captain Stiff Pants?
Yeah, you know, I was kind of surprised myself. I was like, oh, crap. But then thinking about it, even though, yes, these new changelings can completely mimic a person and, you know, we've seen the damage that they're causing. Part of my brain was like, oh, no, are they going to pretend to be him? But no, they can't, because then he has to release commands and like it would just be too much. I think I don't anticipate that he's going to die. I don't think anyone is necessarily going to die. I think there's going to be something coup de grace type thing at the end because I have thoughts. I'll save them for later.
I think John's right. They may have reshot that because I think they might have like, you know, let's give a ship to Seven here, you know, and have John go out in a flaming blaze of honor and saving people's lives scenes. But I don't want him to be disfigured and put into a chair like Pike's going to be, but you know, I just want to see more of Shaw here. Cause this guy's fantastic. So, all right, guys, let's go ahead. And I think it's time to go ahead and hit an away mission here. All right, guys, John, We're going to hit one of your little articles here. You've been doing some stuff for us here on Echo Chamber. Well, not for us, but this is your thing here. And I want to give a shout out to you here because you've been doing some great stuff. And I love the way that you also, I guess, rate the episode, you know. Good job showing that so people, because people love numbers. People love seeing scales, you know. And I love the fact that you do that in there and you dive right into this week's episode here. And I want to pull something from your article here that I want to touch on. You say, Picard's fluid morality, the shapeshift of things to come, question mark. Picard sets up a trap to lure Vadok aboard the Titan, but events prove a lure unto themselves. I see what you did there. Quote, you said, discouraged by the scale of infiltration of the changeling into all levels of Starfleet and the fate of the missing Riker, Picard suggests a Hail Mary answer by tricking Vadok into coming aboard the Titan and hopefully capturing her. It's a long shot, but at first the plan seems to be working as Vadok explores what seems to be the remains of a crippled ship. However, even as Picard, Seven, Jack, and the bridge crew seem to gain the upper hand, they haven't counted on the interference of Lore. If Data can't win over the more dangerous personality in his positronic brain, will any of the crew live long enough and get answers they desperately need? And you mentioned bottle episode. And I did want to touch on that because, well, last week we had Moriarty from the famous episode of TNG, Ship in a Bottle. And so that was kind of nice that we had a little reference to that. But I did want to give people a little background here, and because you go on to say this isn't a bad episode by any stretch, but it's a connective tissue with some of the familiar beats. Cat and mouse games through the corridors of the starship are also one of the staples of Trek stories. Also, sometimes the hallmark of budget-saving ship-in-a-bottle stories. But in the case of Dominion, though the sets themselves are technically limited in a number, it all works to solid effect. Now, before I have you elaborate on that, John, I just want to give the viewers and listeners, and maybe ourselves, a little reminder of bottle episode history. In episodic television, a bottle episode is produced cheaply and restricted in scope to use a fewer regular cast members, effects, and sets as possible. Bottle episodes are usually shot on sets built for other episodes, frequently the main interior sets of the series, and consist largely of dialogue and scenes for which no special preparations are needed. They are commonly used when one script has fallen through and another has to be written in short notice or because of budgetary constraints. Bottle episodes have also been used for dramatic effect, with the limited setting and cast allowing for a slower pace and deeper exploration of character traits and motives. And the term bottle show coined, and this I got this off of Wikipedia just to clarify, the term bottle show was coined by Leslie Stevens, creator and executive producer of the 1960s TV series The Outer Limits, for an episode made in very little time and little cost, as in pulling an episode right out of a bottle like a genie. The earliest known use of the term bottle episode dates back to 2003, according to Wiki here, though. But I like that Scott Brazil, the executive producer of The Shield, described bottle episodes as a, quote, the sad little stepchild whose allowance is docked in order to buy Big Brother a new pair of sneakers. And there has been a list of famous bottle episodes like The West Wing following the September attacks in 2011, or the episode of Chicago Fire in response to the COVID-19. And one of my favorites in the Friends episode of, which was kind of shot in real time, when the one where they're all not ready to go to Ross's lecture. So John, bottle episode, we got that out of the way here. You mentioned it here. This whole season kind of feels like a giant bottle episode, but done in an amazing way on really good sets. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, well, you've just nailed it there. I think one of the interesting, possibly, you almost overlook it because the show's been so good this season, is the fact that it has been done on a very limited number of sets. If this was a normal TV series or a normal Star Trek series, there would be an alien world every week. There would be some massive special effects, which there are in these, but there's so, if you look at the, if I said name the various sort of set pieces or the various sets in this season, really there's only sort of like four or five regular rooms, and the others are exterior effect shots. So you're quite right. I mean, I think after you've hit the nail on the head. Most of this season is almost bottle episodes. I think, particularly with this one, there's a lot of kind of walking and talking or chasing, and yeah, as the case may be. But it's all happening on the ship. It's all probably very much a tribute to the way it's shot, that you could probably, you know, have four or five corridors that are actually the same corridor, for, you know, shot from different angles, different lighting. I don't think that's hurt this season at all. I think that's one of the contributing factors of having stuff that's more character-based, is that you don't necessarily have to have them running around alien worlds. You just have to have them sitting and talking, but have a script that makes that interesting, have performers that can deliver, cinematographers and directors and special effects that can add to that. So, yes, I think the whole season has been a series, not maybe Bottle Show's too extreme, but it certainly has that feel of being more compact and bijou, but right, then the effects broaden everything out that's else that's happening outside the hull.
You know, Haley, I wanted to get your thoughts on this too, but I just wanted to mention, John, because I know you've had a lot of experience in the entertainment industry, interviewing people for movies and TV series, and you're familiar with this term. Mm. And this was one of those terms that I learned later on, because the other gimmick was clip shows, which I hated when I figured out that was a thing, was, you know, and the famous Star Trek TNG clip episode was Shades of Grey. There was the writer's strike, of course. And I prefer the bottle episode because, you know, you can take a script, or you can just, like, you know, take a scene and just kind of keep everyone on set that you've already paid for. You don't take them out to location. You don't have those things, and just do the bottle episode. I prefer that to clip shows. Haley, your thoughts on this kind of clip show season that we're kind of having here?
Honestly, I hadn't really thought about it. So that's a really neat way to take a look at it, because it wasn't even on my mind. I do appreciate, though,
that I think that's a good thing, actually.
Yeah.
The fact that
you don't pick up on
it. You didn't catch on to that is a good thing.
Yeah. And, you know, looking at it now, it's not going to affect my viewing going forward, but I like that it's not something super crazy, because it fits the story, right? If we were constantly going to planets and constantly doing all these other things and seeing all these different sets, it would take away from the story and the heart of all of this, which again is connection, right? As the characters themselves have said, and we've discussed so far. So I like that we're only seeing so many sets, and that we have kind of the same characters from week to week to week. I really appreciate that. So yeah. I think it lends to the story. And if it was something else, like Strange New Worlds, it wouldn't work, because they're out there exploring and it's a different type of story. But for this, I think that works, but I didn't think of it.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely agree. It's this show is, it's getting everything right when it comes to aspects of making a good TV show, even if it is on a budget. So I love that. All right, guys, let's go ahead and get into the next part here. And John, I'm going to go ahead and touch on your article here. And this is a data lore topic here we want to touch on. We see a little bit of both on this show, and it makes for some great tension and drama. And John, as you mentioned in your article here, quote, force fields, ever the savior of fight-to-fight tactics, works extremely well here, entirely too well in separating the bad from the good, until data lore's interference in the system threatens to turn victors into victims. Kudos, as always, to Brent Spiner, who conveys who is in control of the synthetic character's persona with just a movement of the eyebrow and inflection of voice. Let's talk about this scene here, guys. And John, I'm going to start with you. Well said in your article, by the way. And I just want to let people know, you have a lot of other good stuff to state in that article. I'm not telling it all. Make sure you go back and read it. I hope John's not going, dude, shut up.
That's fine. there's a lot of other adequate stuff in there as well. So
Yeah. I had to cherry pick some stuff here, because you had some great topics. So you had made the great mention here about how great Brent Spiner is when it comes to lore, especially when he can switch things around.
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, if you didn't have somebody who was as good as Brent Spiner doing this, this character isn't really dead, we found another way to bring him back, would be getting a little tired by now. But the thing is, he is very good at that, particularly as we're seeing now, flicking between personas. rather than just playing different characters. I found last season, having Brent Spiner, you know, in the 21st century stuff, a bit of a stretch and actually a bit of a dud plot wise. But here, redeemed completely story wise, and very much the inclusion of him is hugely important when you're getting the band together, and the fact that he can play. And it's not even that kind of special effect. You've got the picture there, you know, obviously a split screen of him playing two different characters there. With this, you don't have, you are relying on the actor, literally just slightly different voice, slightly different mannerisms, a slightly arched eyebrow. That's a very tricky thing to do. You know, if you're ever doing like a multiple personality type of thing and it's not special effects and it's down to the actor's face, and almost always it's a close shot for effect. Yeah, but I think it's very easy to underestimate how difficult that is to do convincingly. It's like the visual equivalent of somebody doing multiple voice performances for animation, and you know the way they may have to switch between two different voices to play different characters. I think we underestimate that as an audience, how difficult that is to do when it isn't a special effect. And he's kept it interesting. I wasn't sure if this was going to be, you know, you get halfway through the season and there's no sign of Data or Law, and you've got all these things from the teaser trailer. You've got, you know, you've got Moriarty, you've got Data, Law, and you're thinking, wow, there's only a few episodes left. Is it going to be, you know, a bit of a shove them in? But it's actually worked pretty well. I think we've seen a lot of the stuff from the teaser trailer play out so far, and they've spoon fed it. And definitely Brent Spiner was worth waiting for, I think.
I think those are great points, John. And Haley, I wanted to ask you, because what we have here is not two different people. And also the big question us fans were wondering was, how are they going to bring Data back? Because when Picard says, "I've seen him die twice," you're like, yeah, so have you. You know? How are you going to do this? But I think that it was done really, really well. And having Brent be able to do the, you know, Jekyll and Hyde thing was great. Your thoughts?
Yeah. So when things started going south in this part of the episode, and Geordi and his daughter run out and they're looking at different screens, I immediately, and I apologize, viewers, I was like, shit, it's Lore! And then it was Lore. And I was like, oh, crap. Because Lore just really loves to stir the pot and oh boy. And so I love that how they've brought Data in to this season of Picard. I think it's been really well done. It's definitely interesting because none of us probably saw this coming. Like, we were like, okay, how could they do it? Maybe he's like, you know, mainframe computer type thing. And it was so completely not that. And I love it. And I love this idea of Alton trying to give Data everything that he did want. And, you know, Picard says this in this episode of like, he wanted everything. He wanted to be human, but also still be Data, obviously. And so I love that. I will say there was the little crap moment, and then Geordi got me. And when he is appealing and trying to pull Data out and trying to get Data to come forward and trying to beat back Lore, I was in tears. It was so powerful and moving and whatnot, because, you know, Geordi talks about, you know, I saw you die and that broke me. And I was just like, It broke me too. and I'm a Geordi fan. So like his face and the way LeVar portrayed that and brought that, because in a way, you know, that he, even though he's an actor and he's playing this part, there is that aspect of these guys have been friends for so long. They've played these characters for so long. You know that those emotions to a degree are actually real. And you can see that in Geordi's face. And I'm really interested to see how this is going to play out, because this is another little thread that they've got to play out. Is Data going to be able to overtake Lore and still have those emotions? Are they going to meld together? Please disconnect him from the ship's computer, please, like right now, because that's just not a good thing. And so I really am excited to see how that plays out. But bringing this back, it gave me some really good moments in this episode.
Gotcha. Yeah. Now I agree with you, Haley, and it is emotional for us fans to see Geordi too, LeVar just kick it in, you know, with the emotions. You're like, oh my God, I'm right there with you, man. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Dust in my eye. I'm fine. You know, I will say, like, I've met Brent in Vegas at the convention, and he honestly is such a delight and such a wonderful, humorous person, and he is hilarious. So it is no surprise to me that he can so easily switch, you know, in these characters and do it so minutely that you really know. I mean, fans of TNG know, you're like, oh crap. Even before he talks, you're just like, shit, it's Lore.
Yeah. The thing that I like too, and I have not heard anyone complain or question this, and this is something that nerds would do, why is he older? You know, why don't we have this young looking, you know, Data? And I like budget. What's that?
Budget.
Yeah, exactly. But I like how fans have just been, we're fine with it. We just want to see Brent back, you know, and I think they addressed it in All Good Things, how Data had said in the alternate timeline or whatever, how he wanted to have the gray in his hair. And so we just kind of went with it. And I'm glad. Thank you, fans, for not bitching about that, because I'm not complaining about it. I love it. Just get him in there and have him do his things. And then when he does this wonderful acting, switching back between Data and Lore, it's absolutely wonderful. So
it's interesting as well. Earlier on in the season, they had that very brief scene where they de-aged Patrick Stewart and Jonathan Frakes for that conversation, and that was the one kind of bum note of this season so far. I know a lot of effort went into that, and it was very uncanny valley for me, and I'm glad they haven't had a lot of things where they de-age the character for whatever reason, because that was the one time when I'm going, yeah, that's a special effect, and it's about 80% there, but that 20% is really annoying me. And good try, but yeah, I'm glad they didn't do too much of that this season.
Haley?
I know how they can defeat Lore. Just hold up a mirror. Because he was talking about, like, to Picard, like, you're old. Like, that sucks. And I'm like, dude, do you not know that you look old now? I think it's great, though, because, again, Data wanted to be human.
Yeah.
And he didn't like that his friends were aging, even in TNG, and that he was not. You know, the episode where he puts on a beard and he's like, yeah, when I stroke it thusly, oh my God. You know, so like, I think that it makes sense. And like you said, I'm glad that no one's complaining. But again, I think a lot of us who grew up on TNG, we go, well, that makes sense. Data wanted to become more human. And how to make him more human? By making him look old, just like his friends would.
Well, well said. Yeah. All right, guys, I want to get into the next thing here. And I like to call this Vadic Spirit Animal is Khan. I want to have a little conversation about this, guys, because one of the things that, and you know, when we talk about Khan here, and I got a little picture here I want to show. got a little Khan action figure here. Right. Okay. So at Target, by the way, you can find this there. But I love how we're getting a really cool villain here, and how Amanda is doing a great job portraying this character, and we're getting a little more insight on this character specifically in this episode. But the thing that I love about this being done is that not only does she have kind of a Khan vibe, there's vengeance here, you know, for obvious reasons, but I only have really one big, huge pet peeve with Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And this is going to piss some people off, because Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan is the best Star Trek of the original cast. A lot of people will agree with that. It's hailed as, you know, the movie that saved Star Trek and blah, 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 blah. All those are great points and true. However, the fact that we don't get Khan and Kirk in the same room, the same ship, working face to face, does bug me. because they're both great characters, great actors that I would love to have seen a face-to-face moment. And we didn't get that. However, we're starting to get that here with Vadik. And I want to get your guys' thoughts and comparisons to Vadik slash Khan and what's happening in a kind of similar situation. John, you.
Well, two things. This is very interesting. I didn't know this until I saw an interview, I think yesterday, about this, that nobody was acting opposite Amanda Plummer until episode 5, because she wasn't available. She didn't shoot any of her scenes until around the 5th episode, around the time they were filming the 5th episode. Everybody else was acting to a green screen whenever she came on, because she was busy Ratchet. So they couldn't get it beforehand. That was part of the deal. So it's interesting that for a long time they weren't in the on the same set, and it was episode 5 before they even met. You know, she even met most of the cast, which is I find fascinating when you see how it feels like there's a very organic reaction between what she's saying and doing and how they're doing it.
I want to interrupt real quick, because John, I did want to mention something that you say. That's fascinating, by the way. That is really cool that they didn't know who the villain was going to be.
That's it.
I want to mention something in your article real quick here, though. You said Vadik has always come across as a few drops short of a gallon, an overtly theatrical and twisted supervillain played with relish by Amanda Plummer. However, this is the episode that explains a lot more of her origin, a dark mix of captured changeling and her torturer, driven insane by those experiments and now on a mission of vengeance against the race that tried to annihilate her own. It's a tribute to the performer and the writing that we start to feel sympathy for Vadik without lessening our dislike. It's also worth mentioning that while she's been the main antagonist thus far, and I love what you said here. This cracked me up when I read this. She appears to be taking orders from evil McFloaty Face. So we'll need to know more about him it before we're done. John, I just wanted you to explore on that a little bit more, because she's been amazing.
Yeah, I mean, she's been great. She also evokes, and you've made the Khan comparison, a certain Christopher Plummer's role in Star Trek. I feel little bits of it in there as well.
Undiscovered Country. I was just watching that last night. That is so funny.
Yeah, very much like that, that kind of arch villain. And I wasn't sure. I have to admit, I loved, I've been liking her performance while thinking it's a very kind of, eating the scenery, pantomime-ish. And this was the episode that gives her a needed backstory, and it's pretty dark when you look at it. It's another example of the people, we're supposed, well, not the specific people, but the organization, being actually morally very questionable. She, at this point, we're going like, yeah, I'd be a little bit pissed off, if I'd been experimented on and vivisected and dissected and all those things. So she's every reason to be very pissed off with everything and everybody, and probably completely insane by this point. The interesting thing is, with 3 episodes to go, we tend to forget that she is taking orders. She's a lackey. She's middle management in many ways. Who's the boss? Now, that I'm guessing is going to be, I suspect we're going to find that out in like the end of the penultimate episode, what it is. And, I'm pretty sure it's not William Shatner, but it's but it could be anybody at this point. It could be that's going to be the dun 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 moment, I think. So it's going to be interesting. I mean, she's very, very good. She's a certain type of actor who is just out there. She's a bit like Nicolas Cage. You never know quite what you're going to get from Amanda Plummer. It can be cartoonish, or it can be very serious. And this episode bridges that a little bit. We've seen her as the scenery chewing villain of the piece, and this episode was needed, I think, to give that just that little extra dimension of going, yep, she's an arch villain, cackling and tying people to rail tracks kind of thing, but there is a reason that she's so unbalanced. Kudos to Amanda Plummer, I say, coming on later in the day and really nailing it in her own unique way.
Haley, your thoughts on the comparisons to Khan here? And also, are you a little sympathetic more towards her?
Yeah, so I wasn't really thinking in comparison to Khan, so that's quite an interesting idea. I think they've definitely taken aspects of this, like I'm out for vengeance and revenge and I'm pissed off. And obviously in a different light though, because Khan was out for it for himself, unless you take Into Darkness into factor, and then he was being used by somebody else for his vengeance and blah blah blah. And we won't go there because that one's too polarizing with too many people. But she's being used, and so that's really quite powerful because someone else has seen this pain and this suffering and this anger and is using that to their advantage. Now, who that is, I'm thoroughly intrigued because I don't know if you guys caught it, but when she was talking to the McFloaty face, the person in charge, I gather, is not a changeling because it said you and your kind. And at
Interesting.
first, I thought maybe it was like someone higher up in this channel, in this group, this faction of these changelings
I
who
did
are
catch
able to
that.
mimic stuff and mimic themselves way more human-like. I thought maybe it was someone high up in the echelon, but clearly not. This person is using them and knows how many they are, knows everything. And so I'm thoroughly intrigued as to who this person could be that is using her. It was nice to get some backstory. And I appreciated it more so for the fact that now we understand a little bit more of how they're able to more fully mimic humans. It didn't make me more sympathetic. Like, it sucks that that happened. Again, that was Section 31 and not the entirety of Starfleet. So I get her anger towards Starfleet in general, for using what they learned out of this, but that was Section 31 and not everybody. And so, to take your vengeance out on everyone and the entirety of Starfleet. Which is a con thing, simply because of the actions of a few small people is really quite telling because that is very mirror to current situations and things like that in our world. But also just goes to show you how easily people who are in that situation and have that trauma can be manipulated by others who know of that trauma and can use them in a lot of ways. And so I'm thoroughly intrigued to kind of learn more, but I'm not sympathetic to her. Like, it sucks, but she could have taken that hate and turned it into something else that was more beautiful. And that's a choice. And she chose to do that. So, although I will bring up in the beginning of the episode, and I know this is later, but because it ties to Vadic and her backstory, did you guys know what song was playing in the beginning of the episode?
I
Did you
don't
pick
remember.
up
I
on what
kind
it
of
was?
I did
what
not.
goes the weasel are we talking about? Or the oh, there was
Three Blind Mice.
three blind mice. Sorry, yeah, what goes the weasel,
I,
exactly, three blind mice.
yeah, and that we get later because the person who is experimenting on Vadic and her people would whistle
Whistling.
Three Blind Mice. So now I'm curious. How does that come into play? Because they picked that song for a specific
It's.
reason.
I wondered the same thing. There's been a lot of nursery rhyme, and again, this might be complete coincidence, but exactly what you were thinking there. We've had Pop Goes the Weasel, Three Blind Mice. These are kind of nursery rhymes. I can't help thinking, I'm wondering if this is going to play out through the season for thematic purposes or not.
I like when you notice those little things, Haley. You remind me either I forgot about it or I'm like, I didn't know that. Well done. All right, guys, we're going to go ahead and get into the last main topic here, topic three, and we're going to discuss a little bit of Tuvok here. Tim Russ returns to Star Trek to reprise his character Tuvok, sort of. And we got Tim Russ right there. God, good old Voyager days. Love that. Love that. And John, you have a little bit of a mention of this as well. And I want to mention this here. But before that, just a little related trivia here. In Seven's conversation with the changeling impersonating Tuvok, she deduces that the changeling must be keeping the people they impersonate alive in order to use them for information, given that some of them demonstrate knowledge of close personal details of their lives. This is not the first time that the changelings have used this tactic. In DS9, the changeling kept Julian Bashir alive for over a month while they impersonated him on DS9, and even went as far as to keep Chancellor Martok alive for nearly 2 years, as well as many others. And to transition into your article here, John, you go on to say, Dominion begins with showing us how well you can crank up the tension with words, performances, and camera work rather than action. Seven is engaging in communication with her Voyager crewmate Tuvok, reprised by, of course, Tim Russ in first of two appearances this season, and trying to work out if he's the real deal or a changeling. It's one of those subtext-filled dialogues with each side prodding the other for clarification that the audience does not know what to believe given recent deceptions works very much in the show's favor and the fact that Seven is almost convinced until she tries one more insight and discovers the truth is immensely satisfying. The implications that for the imposter to know certain details, the real Tuvok must have been captured, has huge implications and makes one wonder just how far spread the infiltration by the changelings must be. And in many ways, the season's arc uses the largely foreshortened notion of secret invasion, alien infiltration, first suggested, and I love this throwback here, John, in TNG's 1988 conspiracy episode with the bluegills. John, please elaborate more on this here. It was great to see Tuvok, and I want something that you said earlier in the show was how Data can just switch from Data to Lore, and that how when Seven finally calls out the shapeshifter here, or the changeling, you just see his eyes, see him, you know, change into who he is.
Yeah. It's always a great opportunity. I think you ask any actor, it's always they always love it when they get to do something like that, you know, to have that stuff going on behind the eyes. If you've got a talented actor, they relish that kind of ability to just literally almost shapeshift the face into something, you know, from innocent to guilty or vice versa. Takes a certain art to do it, but yes, Tim Russ definitely did it. It's interesting that, as he said in his own, I think, tweet, that he has two appearances this season, which means we're going to see him again at some point. Now, whether we're going to see the changeling again or whether we're going to get confirmation, you know, that Tuvok's still alive, you know, in some kind of epilogue or whatever.
I was curious how you got that information.
He mentioned it in a tweet. He said that the secret's cool. out. I'm in the first of two appearances this season tonight, or it was Thursday when he said that. So yeah, he spilled the beans. It wasn't me. So he will be back at some point, whether it's just a brief thing or not. But he did say he shot two episodes worth of stuff. So
gotcha. Haley, your thoughts on Tuvok returning, sort of.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it. As I recently, I think it was last year, I don't remember, time's irrelevant anymore, but recently only finished watching Voyager finally. So it was nice to see Tuvok come on, although we're going to use air quotes because he's not Tuvok. So I liked the behind the scenes stuff. Like, you know, they were trying to confirm that it was voice and they're like, yep, that's his voice. That's
that was so cool.
You know, and then
the look later, over the shoulder, like, you know, are you getting this? Is this happening? You know?
Yeah. You know, and you can tell that, like, I like the notion that obviously this isn't the first time that they've done this, that they've reached out to somebody and been trying to figure out, are they a changeling or not? Because you kind of pick up on that as they're looking, as Seven's looking at Picard and she looks over and asks, you know, if they're checking the, you know, his voice signals and stuff like that. And so I like this notion that they're trying to figure out and then realizing, hey, we're on our own. Cause clearly every other time they've tried this, it has not panned out. And so I'm intrigued. It's like, who else they maybe reached out to. So it's going to be really quite fascinating. I liked this notion that he basically just kind of, you know, and he talks about it in the Ready Room, but, you know, just really kind of hints at just a little bit, you know, that it's not Tuvok. And when they finally kind of get that confirmation of like, well, we can't confirm it, but we also can't deny it. And Seven challenges him again with something. Yes.
The mind meld from that episode of Voyager was key. And I love that.
Yeah. And so I think that was really, really well done and a really great way to start this episode, actually. I think that was quite fascinating to see that happen and see everybody kind of working and coordinating together to see what they could determine. And then I pray to God that Riker's not going to turn out looking like that because that was not pretty.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see how deep this is going to go. And it's interesting that we only have a few more episodes left. And I'm wondering, you know, we're wondering, like, how are they going to wrap this up in the rest of the episodes? But maybe they're not. Ugh. And I think that maybe we'll have a conclusion to with this crew and that, but that there's still going to be the threat lying there for either the Titan show. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there, but it's a big question because for them to kind of wrap all this up into one little thing with the rest of the Federation, obviously being severely compromised, I do find fascinating, but I'm prepping myself right now, guys, John, prepping myself that they're not going to wrap up the overall Dominion threat.
I think they'll want to leave a few things just that, you know, dangling there so that if anybody wants to pick them up, they can. I know that the Terminalis has said that Marina Sirtis will feature more in these later episodes. She was because of COVID, she was doing a lot of stuff in London. But you said she could be key story-wise to some of the stuff that's going to happen. So certainly they've got a game plan. They've done all right so far. There's a few things in there, the Jack Crusher stuff I'm still on the fence about. But they've been pacing it reasonably well, I think, for a 10-part series. So, yeah, we'll see.
Haley, you have some changeling looks on your face. What's going through that brain of yours? Come on. Tell me.
I know. You podcast me too much. I'm sitting here and my facial expressions give me away when I'm like, and I'm thinking of things. You know, if we want to talk about this, I can see them potentially wrapping up. So we now know how they were able to make themselves, how these changelings can make themselves appear even more human, right? Obviously, they can't recall everything, and that's how they get tripped up because they don't quite know the stories, and they think they're catching on to that. But I think there's a possibility because we know there's not going to be another season of Picard. We don't know if there's going to be another show after this. Everything else that we currently have is before all of this. And so it's either we're going to have to wait a really, really long time to get anything else from this storyline if they don't wrap everything up until another show comes along. I could see that they can use this information that they got from Vadic because she was cocky, as all villains are, and gave way too much away. They figured out how they could trace them and figure out where they were on the ship. They can take that and use that as a weapon against this specific type of changeling to wipe out these specific types of ones to know exactly who they are. Yep. They might not get the person who's the puppet string master over all of this, but I could see them saving the day at the last minute because it's Star Trek and that's how it always happens in the Federation. I could see them saving everything at the last minute and wiping out, or at least figuring out and rooting out all of these people who are these changeling just seems now the wrong word because they are like a morph changeling. They are like Uber changelings. Let's call them that. I could see them getting and rooting them all out, except for maybe this puppet master, and then another show can come along and pick that up. Because I really, yes, this Dominion thread is really quite interesting. It's fascinating to see it post Deep Space Nine. But at the same time, like, that would just lead to like another yet bigger war, and how they'd play that out again, given everything in the state of how the galaxy was left and the Federation and everything post Deep Space Nine and the Dominion War and yada, yada, yada. I really don't know how else like another show could pick that up and carry that over. And I also like that each show is kind of having its like issues and it's stuff that it's trying to figure out, rather than like, okay, let's take on this thread from this one show and let's carry it over into the next one. And then in the next one and the next one, like,
yeah,
I want them to kind of be their own thing, which is why I love Strange New Worlds, because it is its own thing. It's separate. And it's exploring and doing all these things. And so that's my thought. As far as Jack goes, I have a thought on that because I'm thoroughly intrigued.
You are the oracle of this show. So please, please, please. I must hear.
I'm not exactly sure what happened, but I think in some time where he was not with Dr. Crusher, when he was kind of off on his own, he came to Earth, he tried to find Picard, and Picard talked about, you know, I don't want a family, Starfleet's my family, not realizing that Jack was his kid, yada, yada, yada. I think there's two things. Either someone got him beforehand and did some experiments on him, which he has no knowledge of. Clearly, this Iromatic syndrome maybe isn't a thing, but either someone experimented on him and then sent him on his way as a Trojan horse, or B, he's a uber changeling and just doesn't know it. And the real Jack Crusher is somewhere else, being maybe held captive by the person who's the puppet master and controlling all of this.
John, you have thoughts?
Yeah, two things. Yes, I mean those. I mean the theories about Jack, I think, are the two kind of barometers of that. Clearly, he's not quite who he says he is, and that whole red door motif is a bit of a trope. But you know, he's going to open that door and have his memories come back in some way. I put money on that being a scene, metaphorically in it. I've been wondering whether Beverly is actually everything we think as well. I mean, she says at the beginning of the first episode, "Yeah, trust no one, Jean-Luc," and then she comes along, and if we're to believe everything that she says about Jack, then it feels a little contrived how they're going to make him be not Jack or a different Jack or not really Picard's son or whatever. As soon as you change that history, you've got to question Beverly as well. And Beverly made, and it was the interesting thing about, you know, I'm a doctor, but I think we have to kill her, kind of thing. And I'm just going, that doesn't sound like Beverly, but it could be just an older, more weathered, world-weary Beverly.
I kind of chalk that up to being a mom.
I could well be. But this is why I'm slightly worried about the Jack sort of story, is that we've been told an awful lot of things. Now, if those aren't true, how are they not true? Because if we trust Beverly, then she's not lying. So somebody's swapped out him at some point, or he was, because he said he had this from being a child, which so indicates that he's not being swapped out later. The other thing that you mentioned as well, and the thing about shapeshifters, and I'm not 100% sure about this, and maybe you can clarify for me. We've been saying how wide is the changeling side of it. You know, Jack could be a changeling, Baddick's a changeling. How many changelings are there now? Because if they're supposed to be the people, are they the shapeshifters who Vadik effectively recruited? Are they her fellow prisoners? In which case, there's a limited number. It was like 10, test tubes. Or is it? I'm still not 100% sure on where all these changelings have come from. Are they her faction? Are they another faction? Are they part of the original? Are they a subset? Because at the moment, it's a little bit like the problem I think that Marvel's Secret Invasion is going to have. It's a wonderful dramatic device not to be able to trust the people we trust.
Right.
But how, and you said this, Kevin, how do you resolve that? Because unless you have Duchenne Machina where, we press a button and everybody who's a changeling goes boop at the end of it, then the chances are there's going to be others out there, which you know, would be another thing you could pick up somewhere else in Star Trek. But these are all things that'll be interesting to see which ones they decide. They're going to obviously reveal a lot about Jack in the next episode. You know, that ticks that box off. But everything else, I think, is largely up for grabs. You have to have a satisfactory ending. You can't have a really big cliffhanger ending for the final season of Picard unless you know how and when you're going to pick that up in this case.
Haley, I wanted you to chime in on what John's asking there, because as far as I know, there's the Great Link, which, and we don't know exactly how many come there or how many are done there, but I'm beginning to kind of go with this faction here, especially the way Vadic refers to that specific, what they were tested on and stuff like that and tortured in her mind, and that there is something more of a smaller faction, but still the threat of a larger group could be there. And then maybe there's an ally like we have, like, and I'm not saying an Odo, but maybe an Odo type that gets it. Maybe, I don't know. Haley, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. So, well, in this episode, Vadic says that she was experimented on. She knows her others were as well, but she was able to turn them into being like her. So she's the only one. She's the original that could actually make herself internally and pass all these tests to be more human, and that she can impart that upon others. So yes, my guess is she probably did that with the other other nine that were with her. So that's 10. But then if they got home and went back to their home world, who knows how many more they could have recruited in the same fashion. Yeah. And so we really, I think, don't know exactly how many there could be beyond that original 10. I don't think it's a large number, but I definitely think there is a great number that are very much similar. But she was the original starting point. She's the one who says, I was able to do this and impart this on others through her learning of being experimented on. So I'm really intrigued as to this. Again, I think that through that experimentation and whatnot, learning about it and hearing it from Vadic, they can devise a way to either destroy them or at least capture them and make it so that they are able to know who's who, because I mean, that harkens back to Deep Space Nine and them learning how to do that blood test to know if someone was a changeling or not. And this goes well beyond it just simply because a blood test doesn't work anymore.
Are they all aboard? And correct me if I'm wrong. Have we seen them, any of them, use a transporter yet? Or have they all, because they always seem to make a point of coming across by shuttle. Whatever. That was the whole point. We didn't know whether Michelle Forbes, Roe was one or not, because she came via a shuttle. Have we seen any of them? Did Vadic beam on board the Titan, or did she come by other than, because they seem to be avoiding transporters at the moment. I'm just wondering if that was a plot device.
John, you're kind of blowing my brain here a little bit. I gotta pay attention to that next time. That's a good point. Yeah, because they love like going into the crevices of the hallways and stuff like that and escaping that way. So that's a good point.
They made it like a story point a little bit earlier on that they're going to come across by shuttle. They're not using the transporters, and I always thought, was there a reason for that? And then it's been consistent all the way through the episodes, I think, but I don't know whether it's an important thing or whether that was just a story device to make it more dangerous.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you think about it, they are, by their molecular structure, even though they're able to pass off as humans and be solids, look like solids, by their molecular structure, they're still technically not. And so a transporter would probably, I mean, who knows? Anytime that we ever see like a fluid being transported in Star Trek, it's always in a canister, right? So it's always in something that contains it, makes it safe to transport. So a fluid being transported would probably, the molecular structure would change it too much. It would disintegrate probably maybe in some fashion. We don't know. So
I'm sure they can explain it. If it's not, I'm sure they can explain it away with one line of dialogue. You know, it's not, but it's just one thing. I wonder if this is a big plot point, but maybe not. Maybe it's just an affectation.
Well, Haley is our science officer, so that was pretty cool. All right, guys, we're going to do a warp speed version of the next away mission here, guys, because I just want to mention a couple of things in trivia here. You know, it's interesting because there's been references to Proteus here. And the Greek mythology, Proteus was one of the early sea gods. He was considered the god of elusive sea change, referring to the constant changing nature of the sea and the liquid quality of water. And as such, Proteus was capable of changing his shape. Hmm. Proteus also had the ability to foresee the future, but disliked people always wanting him to tell their future and would change shape in order to avoid them. It's kind of like being the palm reader, like, where I'm closing at 5, bro. I got to go, you know, type of thing there. And I did want to mention a shout out to the battles of Chintaka. The Titan is hiding in a starship scrap graveyard in the Chintaka system. And of course, this is the big battle with the Cardassian space near the Federation border. And I found this little thing here of the Allied fleets at the time that worked. And this was mentioned again in Deep Space Nine, where they had the second battle in the episode Tears of the Prophet. And this is where you have the Cardassian Union against the Allied fleets of the Federation, the Klingon and the Romulans. And so I thought that was pretty cool, too. So, but first, guys, before we wrap things up, I did want to mention the Ready Room here, because, of course, in the Ready Room, we had Tim Russ. And don't worry if you guys haven't seen it. I will mention here that the important interview with Tim Russ, there were some other cool things, too, that I want to touch on as well. We saw, of course, the Tim Russ interview. We had a little bit of Star Trek trivia. They did talk about Project Proteus and a little more interview with Amanda Plummer there as well. And they also discussed the suiting up, which was, of course, the wonderful, I think it's Michael Crow, who is the costume designer. But I wanted to talk first about Tuvix here, guys. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that Will said, that if I did not ask you, Tim Russ, about Tuvix, the fans would be upset with me. And this was a very important moment in Star Trek history, because this is where Tuvok and Neelix get accidentally put into one. I think it was a transporter accident here, if I remember correctly, creating Tuvix. And then there was the moral dilemma of Tuvix, played by this actor who did not want to be separated. He did not want to be taken apart. And it was a really, really good episode. And I just want to get your thoughts on this, John. I'm sure you remember this episode.
Yeah, I mean, Star Trek has so much potential. And most of the time, and I don't mean this anything against Star Trek, because it's true of every show, you know, it has a template. It has a formula that it sticks to and does variations thereof. And really good shows every so often come up with an idea where you just go, oh, this is a good one. You know, this is not a show of the, you know, a template of the week. This is something people are going to be talking about, and it's memorable, and people will be having the water cooler moments and arguing about this. And of course, as you say, you have a huge moral dilemma in that episode of having two regular characters, and you presume as an audience member we're going to finish up that way, but suddenly you have another character that grows on you very quickly, a stunning performance, and a really good episode. And so you are not sure as that episode goes whether you want the outcome you expect to be the outcome that you eventually want. And in other shows, it would be a way to write out characters, you know, and introduce a new one. And there's a real sense of that as you get through that episode of kind of wanting that to happen. Nothing against any of the actors, but you start thinking this is really interesting. This is a whole. You can see how this could be taken if Tuvix sticks around, and a genuine, fantastic story arc going forward. So yeah, as soon as you get to that, it's like, oh, okay. And anytime you can wrong foot the audience a little bit or make them root in an opposite way than they expect to is always a good thing. And there will be people arguing to this day about the morality of that episode. And I like the fact that the episode acknowledged that, you know, this wasn't like it was very kind of meta in the sense of you get the feeling, even though it wasn't really mentioned, you know, as a recurring thing to the series, that the characters on board Voyager were probably not going to be very happy and settled about this for some time to come. There were a lot of conversations, you know, in scenes we didn't see. And anytime a show can get the audience arguing about morality, you've done something right. And the fact that it's mentioned so long, you know, so many years later, kudos.
Yeah, that's a great point, John. And I did want to give a shout out to actor Tom Wright, who played Tuvix in this episode. And I completely, when I was doing my research, we've recently seen him in the wonderful miniseries on Amazon based on the book Daisy Jones and the Six. He plays the manager, Teddy Price, that brings this group, these guys together to form this kind of super band. And if you're kind of curious, it's a fictional tale, but it's pretty much, it's been proven that it's based on the Fleetwood Mac type of scenario that was happening with the infighting and the relationships that they had. And they would be writing songs about each other afterwards. But brilliantly played though by Tom Wright. I wanted to give your thoughts also, Haley, on Tuvix here, Tom Wright.
Yeah, you know, I loved that Will was like, I have to ask, I have to talk to you about it because I will be butchered otherwise, basically, if I don't ask you. And, you know, I can imagine, you know, there's always those questions. I've gone to conventions and actors always seem to get asked the same questions. And sometimes you're just like, oh, really? Do we have to revisit this question again? But I liked that Tim addressed this. And I really appreciated what he said in saying that, you know, good episodes, and Star Trek does this, it makes you question and it makes you really think about the choices that these characters have made, and is it the right one? And it makes you question yourself, what would you do in that situation? And I like that he talked about, you know, at the end, Janeway did make the right decision. And I know fans, this is almost more polarizing than like the Kirk or Picard story, you know, Star Trek or Star Wars. It's like, did Janeway make the right choice? You know, I've heard multiple discussions about this with people. And at the time I hadn't watched Voyager. So I was like, I have no input. But I really like that he took this and he said, you know, she did make the right choice. It was the hard choice, but it was the right choice, because here you have two species that have melded into one, and Tuvok has a family, and him being Vulcan, he will live a long time and he will continue to create life and contribute. And you have Neelix, who is a member of a species, and he will continue to live on and can have a family and carry on his race. But then you have Tuvix, and he's one, and he is the only one, and it ends with him when he dies. And I just thought, wow, you know, like that was such a poignant way to explain that. Yes, Janeway did make the right choice. And even though it was hard, and he talks about, you know, when she leaves and she walks out in her face, and it was a difficult decision, it was still ultimately the right one. And I really appreciated that.
That's cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, when you watch that scene at the end of that episode of Voyager and you see Janeway walking away, you just see the turmoil on her face. And it was like one of the toughest decisions that she had to make. Great, great episode. I want to get your guys' thoughts on the last topic that I really want to hit on with the Radio Room was the costumes. But before I do, I just want to share a personal moment I had when I actually met Tim Russ for the first time. And it was in those early conventions that they had in Pasadena, the early creation events at the Pasadena Convention Center. And it was one of the first Pasadena creation Star Trek conventions that had like the whole crew of Voyager there signing. And they actually had them signing outside on these tables. And you kind of went through this corral and getting autographs and stuff like that. And it was actually kind of cool, but the only person that wasn't there was Tim Russ. And we had gotten a tip, me and my group had gotten a tip, because we were friends with the guys that do those hyperlight art, cool Star Trek things. And we're always at all of the Star Trek convention. I think that's the name of the company. And they said, well, he can't be there because he's actually performing a gig with his brother at a little bar somewhere, right? And so we decided to go down there to see if he was actually there. And I took my like I had a Tuvok card that was like a promotional card. It was the only card at the time for the company I was working for, Decipher, that made the Star Trek card game at the time. So we were there as an exhibitor, and the only card I had of the company was this like promo card that came out of this special box. So I just took it with me just in case in a pen. And we showed up, and it was this great little bar. I don't remember the name of it, but he was playing in a trio with him and his brother and a drummer, singing kind of like jazz songs and blues songs and stuff. And if you don't know this, Tim Russ is a fantastic musician and a great singer. And both him and his brother are musically inclined, and they've had this little band together. And what was really cool is that both him and his brother would change like bass and guitar and play. And I could tell there was a couple of other Star Trek fans that were there that got the tip that he'd be there. We watched the entire show, and then he knew that there were some Star Trek fans there. He took time to talk to them, and he signed my card, and he was very, very sweet. And so it was just a moment that you don't normally get with a fellow like Star Trek actor. And it was one of the things that I cherish. So I just had to share that real quick. John, your thoughts on the costumes? This is one of the things they touched on this here. I don't know what it is, but man, Michael Crow is killing it here. Mm-hmm. There was a great interview with him talking about it. And it was funny too, because I think it was Crusher. She's had the most costume changes in this one too. Mm-hmm. Everyone had in a moment in their interview, including Todd Stashwick and everyone else, they all mentioned something about the costumes and how much more comfortable they were. John, your thoughts on the costumes of season 3 of Star Trek Picard?
Yeah, and it's one of those things that when it's done badly, you notice. And when it's done well, you don't notice. You might sort of say, oh, that looks... But it takes a second to go, oh, yeah, those costumes look... Because it's part and parcel. It's like sound. It's like lighting. It's one of those things that, as I say, if you get it wrong, if you get it right, it's part of the artistic palette. And yeah, I think it's very easy to overlook this season that people have looked good, and it's not like, look, I'm wearing a fantastic costume. It's I move it. Well, maybe Amanda Plummer, you know, hello, I'm evil. But everybody else, it's just the way it's, if you are comfortable, it's like, I think it was Laurence Olivier, wasn't it? Who was asked how he can, you know, how he acted. And he said, it starts with the shoes. You know, he has to find a pair of shoes that help him walk in a certain way. You had to help him walk in a certain way, which got him to move. And that was everything else to do with the character, and everything else was acting, dear boy. But it was, I think that's very much the case of it, that you look at something like this and you see these little elements, and really it's sometimes the second time around that you actually see something and go, oh yeah, look at that costume, look at that lighting, look at the, you know, and it's those contributing factors, because they're working so well that they fill up the palette. And I think that's very true in this season, that it's one of the contributing factors of how organic it feels, is that the actors look comfortable or uncomfortable as needed within the scene.
Haley, that's some great points by John there. Comfortability was one of the things that was brought up by a couple of the actors, and they are looking sharp. Your thoughts on the wardrobe?
Yeah, no, I really like it. I love the details. It's so insane, the little details. You know, they're talking about the leather jackets that they've been wearing, and how if the camera zoomed in really close, the little punch outs on the shoulders would be deltas. And I love that attention to detail. It's really quite fascinating to hear how they make these. You know, they talked about the leather costumes, and they like wore them down and sanded them and painted them and like all this stuff, and you just don't think of all these little details that go into something that if it is like John said, if it's done well, you just don't really even think of it. It's just wonderful. And I liked how LeVar and Brent and Jonathan Frakes were talking about how comfortable everything was and wanting to be comfortable, because the first few seasons of TNG, the outfits, the uniforms were not comfortable. So I really like the attention to detail that they've put into this. And I totally have to say, I agree with Riker, with Jonathan Frakes. If I was on set and on the cast, that jacket would be going home.
Yeah, exactly.
It wouldn't be staying.
Two other things I wanted to mention real quick before we get some contact information here is there was a great story that Tim was talking to Will about. I love Will hosting this because he gets it. He's part of the family. And Tim mentions that when he was on the fifth season of Voyager and he had his makeup on and everything, and you know, he's been there, done that. And he sees Brent Spiner out of costume come up on a golf cart, stop and look at him going, fifth season, huh? I thought that was hilarious.
Oh my God, it's great.
Because Will got that. Just what it feels like when you're that far into a show and you've paid your dues. The other thing I just wanted to mention too, and I'm not going to mention what was on the teaser for the next episode. They always show a little clip, but we know Vadic's on the ship now, and I love how Will goes, Vadic's in command of the Titan. Talk about a changeling in scenery. Thank you very much. All right, guys, let's get in some contact information here. First of all, before we do that, I did want to give a shout out to the director of this episode, Deborah Kampmeyer. In the behind the scenes that you see in the Ready Room here, you do get to see her working behind the scenes and giving away. And I thought it was really well directed. And I also don't want to give her a shout out. She directed a couple episodes of one of my favorite guilty pleasure shows last year, The Gilded Age on HBO. Absolutely loved it. She also she's done some Walking Dead, Discovery as well. So I just want to give a shout out to her. And John, by the way, Terry Metalis, I hope they brought him into a room and saying, what about doing a Titan show with Sean? Just saying.
But I mean, one thing as well, Star Trek has such good directors involved. I mean, obviously, yeah. John Brakes, you know, is on there. Doug Arniokoski's, you know, but does at least two every season. The direction of all the episodes, while it's seamlessly flowing most of the time, each episode is, it's obviously got really good directors, some of which who know it very well and some of it who probably know it less well, but are still doing a sterling job. And you know, they've done really well this year, I think. Absolutely seamless.
Yeah. Agreed. All right, John. Well, this has been the Union Federation podcast. Go ahead and let us know about Echo Chamber. What's going on with you, man?
If you want to see sort of fairly regular reviews, particularly of genre stuff, but some other stuff as well, echochamber.online is my website. You can find me on Twitter, There Goes the Day, and Facebook, John Mosby, and I'm popping up all over the Fandom Podcast Network, so I'm like a bad penny, like a changeling.
Yeah, you are.
You're showing up when you don't need me. There we go.
Yeah, we appreciate you again coming on for this episode of Picard on Union Federation discussing Dominion. Haley, how can we get a hold of you?
You can find me on Twitter. I am at Trekkie01D, and then I'm also lurking in our Facebook group.
Yeah, you are. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us here on the Fandom Podcast Network. Please subscribe to us on YouTube. Watch our videos there. Please share them out. Also, as Haley mentioned, we have the Union Federation Facebook group where we discuss both, of course, Star Trek Picard, and the Orville, too. And we'll be doing more of that later. So make sure you check us out there. My name is Kevin. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Spartan_Phoenix. fpnet.podbean.com is where you can find all the audio versions of these shows. So make sure you check that out. John, thank you so much again for coming on, man. I love your articles. I totally tell everyone to go check them out. And I know I've been bugging you to make sure you make those public. Thank you for doing so.
Absolutely. I made the mistake. I will not make that mistake again.
Guys, thank you so much, and looking forward to next week's episode. It is called Surrender of Star Trek Picard, Episode 8, Season 3. We'll see you guys next time.